From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The United States has officially rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement to slow the devastating effects of climate change. And in another sign that the tone in Washington has shifted with a new president, Joe Biden told a group of European leaders who gathered virtually today that America is back.
The last 4 years have been hard, but Europe and the United States have to lead with confidence once more, with faith in our capacities, a commitment to our own renewal, with trust in one another.
For this and more, we've got with us for our Friday Politics Roundtable, Aisha Roscoe, who is NPR's White House correspondent. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
Hello. And Olivia Nuzzi, who is a Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Welcome, Olivia.
Thank you for having me.
Well, world leaders knew Biden well before when he was vice president under Obama. Is it a sure thing that old alliances that were strained under former President Trump will be easily restored under President Biden? What signs are you watching for there, Olivia?
Well, it's interesting. On the campaign trail, this was something that Biden frequently talked about. He said that he had personal relationships with world leaders, that he continued to speak to them even after his time as vice president was over. It was sort of a way for him to draw a distinction between him and the former president, Donald Trump, and also for him to talk about his foreign policy experience. You know, he did not have, I think, the most traditional foreign policy experience during his time in Washington, but he did his best to kind of use his personality and talk about the personal relationships that he was able to forge over his multi-decade career here. Whether or not that's going to mean that things will immediately be restored to the way that they were in the Obama era, I think that remains to be seen. That's certainly been Joe Biden's hope, and that has been something across the board with every issue that he has been pitching since he started running for president 2 years ago at this point, that basically it would amount, if he were elected, it would amount to an Obama restoration. They're still talking about it that way, and it seems as if they are still hoping that that will be the case, whether we're talking about climate, we're talking about the Iran deal, we're talking about our foreign policy more broadly. But I think it's one of those things that, unfortunately, the realistic answer is time will tell.
Well, I want to bring Aisha in here, and you mentioned Iran. The Biden administration has formally offered to restart nuclear talks with Iran as a way to restore the deal that former President Trump rejected. Aisha, how is that being received?
Well, you know, I think that this was something that is not unexpected, because there was a part of the tensions between the U.S. and Europe was the decision of the former Trump administration to unilaterally pull out of the deal with Iran, even though, Iran was, not going against that deal, was in compliance with the deal. And that left allies in the region kind of out to dry, in a sense, because they had signed on to the deal. So I think it's not surprising, but it's going to be a difficult situation either way. It's not clear how these talks would start back up. And obviously Iran is still a threat. And even though during the Trump administration complained about was this idea that the Iran nuclear deal did not deal with all of the other malign activities that Iran was engaged in. But even pulling out of the deal, it did not change Iran's posture in the region. And obviously there were very strong tensions between the U.S. and Iran during the Trump administration. And that hasn't changed right now. So I think those are things that the Biden administration will have to figure out how to deal with.
That is an important story, and we're going to talk about it elsewhere in the show today. I do want to talk about this other political development, though. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz apologizing several times and in several ways yesterday for taking his family to Cancun while millions of Texans were sitting in the freezing cold, boiling their water at home during the state's power grid crisis. Here's Ted Cruz on Fox News last night.
As I was heading down there, I started to have second thoughts almost immediately, because the crisis here in Texas, you need to be here on the ground. And as much as you can do by phone and Zoom, it's not the same as being here.
Aisha, this is not a good look for Senator Cruz. Do you think he realizes how big of a mistake he made?
I think he realizes it, because that's why he was apologizing any and everywhere yesterday. Mm. It is, you know, this is the sort of thing that in the past could have been viewed as career suicide. You have this huge catastrophe in your state, and then for a politician, and so you have this huge catastrophe, and then you head off with your family for a luxury vacation, where people, you know, people are dying, people are suffering right now. It is the idea that he couldn't have done much because he's a federal, you know, he's a federal lawmaker, doesn't really hold weight when people, you know, he has all of these connections in Texas. He could have been, you know, arranging things, using his platform to put pressure on other people. And just the idea of not suffering with the people in your state who are going through something. So I think that's why you saw him apologize. And I think this is a difficult thing to just quickly recover from. This is going to follow him, you know, not saying that he can't recover from it, but it will definitely be something that's going to be brought up for against him whenever he runs again.
Well, Olivia, just a few weeks ago, I think it was in December, Ted Cruz called the mayor of Austin a hypocrite for going to Mexico during the pandemic. And to me, it seems here that the bigger story is just how often political leaders, it seems like in this day and age, although I know this has probably been going on for a long time or forever, that they can say and do anything without consequence.
Right. Well, I think that the Trump era certainly emboldened lawmakers to feel that way. But I wanted to point out about Ted Cruz, it is true that he apologized yesterday. And it's true that even in that Fox News segment with Sean Hannity that we just listened to, that he's apologized. But first, Sean Hannity spent a couple minutes trying to absolve Cruz of any wrongdoing. And Ted Cruz tried to absolve himself of any wrongdoing by pointing out that he had taken seriously a Fox News meteorologist saying that the weather was going to be much worse this week than anyone was anticipating. So Ted Cruz seems to be kind of having it one way when he speaks to local media, when he speaks to the national mainstream press, and another way when he's on Fox News and he's talking to the people who you could consider to be his base of supporters. And I think that's an important thing to note, that the way that our media is fractured is something that people like Ted Cruz seem to really be attempting to take advantage of.
Point taken there. You know, we've seen how few politicians actually survive a weather disaster unscathed. We remember George W. Bush will forever be linked to Hurricane Katrina. You know, this morning, President Biden told reporters he'll decide early next week whether to go forward with a trip to Texas. Is this a leadership test for Biden? How is he doing on this front, Aisha?
I do think it's a leadership test because, you know, as you said, these major disasters can be really defining moments. I do think in this case, because the Biden administration has, for the most part, approached this with a seriousness, you know, and have, you know, they've done the disaster reliefs, you know, the disaster declarations. They've sent in FEMA. And there doesn't seem to be much complaints about the federal response at this point. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of weight at this point on President Biden. He's done the leadership things. He's said the right things. He's made the calls, and he's not being seen as kind of sleeping on duty. Now, obviously, these things can change very quickly, and they'll have to make sure that the federal government continues to meet the needs of Texas. But right now, it doesn't seem like the focus is really on him, especially when you have like Senator Ted Cruz kind of taking some of the heat off of everyone.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point that Aisha makes there, that Ted Cruz has kind of bestowed this gift on President Biden, whereas ordinarily I think we might be watching very closely how the new president of the United States handles his first big weather crisis when Americans are dying. And because of what Ted Cruz did, the focus is really on Ted Cruz and not on Joe Biden, and he's not receiving very much criticism at all.
Yeah. You know what? With the little bit of time that we have with you, I want to ask you a question. Democrats unveiled this comprehensive immigration reform without the border security overhaul that attracts Republicans to the issue. It includes an 8-year pathway to citizenship for undocumented migrants and a 3-year pathway for Dreamers. How are Democrats going to get those 60 votes in the Senate? With the minute I have left with you, Aisha.
It's not clear at all how they'll do it, and they haven't really, you know, Jen Psaki has press secretary Jen Psaki has been pressed on this, how their strategy, and all we know right now is that it's been rolled out. This is a heavy lift, and they have a lot of other things on their plate. This is going to be tough to get done, and other administrations have not succeeded.
Yeah, Biden also wants to pass his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package by mid-March, when extended benefits are due to expire. Aisha Roscoe is NPR's White House correspondent, and Olivia Nuzzi is as Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Federal Communications Commission has a new leader. Jessica Rosenworcel was appointed as acting chairwoman last month by President Biden. And her first task, making what she calls long overdue upgrades to improve the FCC's flawed broadband maps. This is important, she says, because it's the first step in bridging the digital divide. And acting FCC chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel joins us now for more. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So you're implementing a couple of changes in the effort to expand broadband. But there are a couple of hurdles, right? The FCC has been criticized for years about inaccuracies in the data that often overstates high-speed internet coverage. And you're implementing a couple of changes. One big step is your announcement of a new task force to implement upgrades to these broadband maps. But you say it's actually going to take a while to get there. How come?
Well, if we want to solve our nation's digital divide, the first thing we're going to need to have is better data. The sad truth is that I inherited an agency that didn't know with precision where broadband is and is not in communities across the country. So job one is figuring that out with some precision. And late last year, in appropriations legislation, Congress provided the FCC with funding to really start mapping in a granular way broadband all across this country. So right out of the gate, I was thought it was important to get that started, but this is not something that we're going to be able to do overnight. And we're simultaneously going to have to work on getting broadband to the places that we know there is no service right now.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to do two things at once.
Let's talk a little bit more about that push to get access to places that don't have it. You're also implementing something called the Emergency Broadband Benefit, which gives people discounts on new broadband access. How are you reaching people to make sure they're able to take advantage of that new program?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. The Emergency Broadband Benefit is our nation's biggest ever project to make sure that we get high-speed service to households nationwide who may not be able to afford it. We know that this pandemic has moved so much of modern life online, and a lot of households are struggling with the economic strain from this crisis. So Congress provided the FCC with more than $3 billion to set up a program to discount by $50 a month broadband connectivity to low-income households or households that have suffered from unemployment and otherwise are having a hard time right now. So now we're working to finalize our rules, and then we're going to have to work just as hard to get the word out and do outreach so people know this service is available and can take advantage of it.
Right. Why are there populations who still don't have access to broadband? I mean, over 90% of the country has access to high-speed internet. What are some of the challenges in those places that don't have it?
I think there are two problems in our nation's digital divide. The first is deployment. We've got some rural and remote areas in this country where the geography may be beautiful, but it's really difficult to, in a cost-effective way, build the infrastructure to every household. And we've got to work to help support the providers that are in those areas willing to try to serve those households with support from Washington and support from state funds as well. But we've also got this other challenge, which is even bigger. We have many more households in urban and suburban America that are struggling to afford broadband consistently. And that's where that emergency broadband benefit program we discussed comes in, because it will help them by supporting and defraying the cost of getting online, which is so important during this pandemic.
Last year, under former President Trump, the FCC designated the Chinese company Huawei a national security threat. Now Huawei is asking you to overturn that decision. So far, the Biden administration is standing by it. Huawei calls this designation arbitrary and says it's harming the telecom industry overall. What is your response to that?
Well, I think that the FCC is going to be able to defend its earlier decision in court. We know that when there is insecure network equipment out there in our communications networks, it can jeopardize the security of communications in the United States. And we're concerned about equipment from this company. And so we made the decision that FCC programs should not subsidize its deployment. And the company is taking us to court over that decision. But again, it's one that I think we can defend in court, and I expect us to be successful.
What about this idea, though, that they're saying that it's harmful overall to the entire telecom industry? Is there any truth in that?
I think the decision we made stands. We are concerned about security vulnerabilities and their equipment, and we do not believe that federal government programs should subsidize its deployment. That's the decision we made before, and I think it is one that we will be able to defend in court successfully.
Jessica Rosenworcel is the acting chairwoman of the Federal Communications Commission. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's turn now to our weekly social media roundup to see how people are responding to the news online. Femi Okay is with us. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, hello. I guess we should start with what's been happening in Texas this week.
Oh, my goodness. So many intimate pictures. Hello, Peter. It's just been distracted by how much intimacy there was with the way that Texans were documenting what was happening to their homes and their surroundings. There were a couple of moments that stopped me scrolling. Those pictures, those posts that really jump out at you. One was of a pizzeria in San Antonio, where the workers were so exhausted because they'd been delivering and giving out pizzas to all of the people who've lost their electricity, lost their power in Texas. That kind of summed up what it meant down on the ground. A couple of other images that, again, jumped out at me. Sea turtles were freezing in the sea.
Yes,
Eric posts that thousands of cold, stunned sea turtles were in the South Padre Island Convention Center. Volunteers were trying to keep them warm, trying to save them. Some of them may not make it. Hashtag Texas freeze. And one more picture really worth looking up, which was burst pipes. We've seen so many burst pipes coming out of Texas homes. This one was of a parking garage, and the burst pipe had happened over a car, and the car had frozen like an ice sculpture under this block of ice. There's so much to see and showing so much of the pain and the intimacy of what it means to have your life turned upside down by the weather and in an unusual situation as well. Peter.
Yeah, you know, it's terrible for me to see these pictures and these videos because it's as if one disaster wasn't enough, the pandemic, right? Now this. But it leads us to this next thing, which is that a lot of people right now are looking to help, and they're using social media to form mutual aid groups. What are you seeing?
This is some of the favorite parts of being on social right now, because you're seeing the problem. I'm also seeing the solution as well. There's some high-profile Texans stepping up. So a lot of Beyoncé fans, a lot of the Beyoncé Foundation, they're working with not-for-profits, for example. So that's that. The celebrities are using their platforms. But the real sense of community coming from regular people helping regular people. Adriana.KMS is on TikTok. This is a great example. She says, hey, here's a tip for the northern states. I'm from Pennsylvania. And then she then gives them, down in the south, anybody who doesn't know what it's like to have this deep freeze, step-by-step guide to stop your pipes from freezing and then destroying your home. Fill your bathtub, your bathtub with water. Turn off your water. Drain your faucets. Literally a step-by-step guide. It's like a how-to from stop your house from freezing and from the pipes from bursting. That was so kind, so helpful, and just volunteered.
Yeah. Well, someone, Femi, who is in trouble for not doing enough to help or anything to help, really, is Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who was caught traveling to Cancun this week as many Texans sat in the dark without running water, without heat. And Femi, we've talked about the politics of this story elsewhere on the show, but we come to you with it because this actually got started on social media, didn't it?
It did. I suppose the moral of this story is you can't really sneak off to a little warm, long weekend anywhere if you're really famous and you're going through the airport. So Sam Deutsch posted one of the early pictures that was tweeted out. He's incredulous. Did Ted Cruz really just fly to Cancun today? It took a little while to work out then. Yes, it really was Ted Cruz, and people were doing some detective work, looking at the mask. Was that the mask he was wearing in the Senate? And they basically worked out, yes, it's him. It really is Ted Cruz on his way to Cancun. Pictures of him with his family on the plane all confirmed that he really did go on a trip. Now, it ended up being a very short trip to Cancun and then came back. Because once this Twitter storm, there was a winter storm, winter freeze storm, obviously over Texas and elsewhere across the country. But there was a Twitter storm that basically dragged the senator back to Texas. Some of the comments I heard was on social. MAGA Antoinette, let regular people eat snow. Ted Cruz fans were standing up for him. It was like, yeah, the senator should be able to go away on vacation. What's the big deal? What is he able to do? But I know it's about optics, and you talked about this politically, but also visually about optics. And Peter, I suppose the surprise that I saw that I hadn't taken into account and really kind of jumped out at me was a journalist called Michael Hardy. He drove past the Cruz house and found peeking out of the window a little forlorn little poodle. This is apparently the Cruz poodle called Snowflake, appropriately named, who was apparently left behind. He didn't go to Cancun, and apparently in a very cold house. That tipped people over the edge, and then they got even more angrier with the senator of that reason.
Did you see the meme of Ted Cruz walking with his roller bag across the surface of Mars?
Yes.
We're not going to have time to get to the Mars rover, but I wish we could. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
One of the premier science fiction writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler imagined worlds that were radically different and strikingly similar to the one we live in today.
For our Black History Month special series, The Cautionary Tales and the Reasons for Hope that Octavia Butler left us.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
It goes without saying that people are stressed out right now, and an alarming rate of people are coping during this pandemic by using drugs. The CDC reports that over a 12-month period ending in June, more than 81,000 people have died from overdoses. That's the highest overdose death toll the U.S. has seen in a single year. Usha Lee McFarling recently reported on this. She's an L.A.-based correspondent for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Usha, we know stress plays a huge part, but what about some of the other reasons we may be seeing an uptick in the use of drugs and deaths?
I think the first thing people will point to is the isolation. Addiction is a disease of isolation. People are living alone. They're not accountable for anyone. They don't have their normal support systems. They can't go out and relieve stress, maybe in normal ways, like going to the movies or out to dinner in a lot of parts of the country. Also, there's a lot of economic hardship right now and job loss, and that's another known trigger of substance abuse and addiction.
You also write that people are doing things like buying from unknown suppliers because the supply chain is off. And also, as you said, with that isolation, there's no one around to intervene if someone is overdosing.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of factors. Drugs are increasingly laced with synthetic opioids like fentanyl, which can kill in the tiniest amounts. So people were getting supplies they didn't know, maybe stronger than they were used to. And then again, people sadly are being found alone, you know, right there in the T stations of Boston, on the streets of Philadelphia, here in Los Angeles. Maybe they could have been saved if they'd been with someone.
I spoke with an addiction specialist a few months ago who told us virtual addiction treatment and recovery sessions are helpful, but when it comes to this kind of work, nothing beats seeing a person face to face. And that made me think about people who don't even have access to technology. What are you learning through your reporting?
Yeah, there's a lot of issues. I mean, it's not only the patients that are frustrated with virtual, it's physicians too. I mean, they want to establish trust. They want to be there for people. And so they feel like it's definitely a second best. Many people can't connect. So patients have disappeared or dropped off, or they try to call in from like the McDonald's parking lot with Wi-Fi. And a lot of 12-step meetings for AA and Narcotics Anonymous have stopped because people can't meet online. A few have, and people who attend those say, you know, they're grateful for it, but they hate it. So people are suffering. And one person who's recovering told me, like, the first thing he will do when things are safe, the very first thing is go to a meeting.
You mentioned fentanyl. The use of opioid fentanyl has already been a major problem in this country. But there had been major progress in fighting it before this pandemic. How has the emphasis on COVID-19 specifically impacted health professionals' ability to continue this work?
Yeah, I would say people in addiction medicine are literally heartbroken. Opioid, it was a big problem, the epidemic, before COVID came. But they were seeing some progress. You know, prescriptions for opioids for pain were down. Deaths had plateaued in 2018, and they were hoping that they could continue to push to lower the suffering and lower the amount of deaths. But the pandemic understandably took all the resources of public health to put toward the pandemic. And this suffering and pain, I think, is something people are not even aware of, because the pandemic is just front and center for everyone, including public health officials. And addiction medicine physicians want to change that. They want people to be aware that this is a big problem and it needs some attention. And it's only getting worse.
Ushalee McFarling is an LA-based correspondent with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. We'll link you to her article at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
And it's Friday. Let's get a head start on the weekend. Lars Gotrich is a producer with NPR Music, and like the rest of us, he's been daydreaming about the end of the pandemic, getting out of his house and back into the music scene. Lars also writes the Vikings Choice newsletter, and he's here to share some of the music he's been listening to this week. Lars, welcome.
Hey, all. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. And I presume the Viking is you.
Yes, I am the Viking. When I appeared on NPR's All Songs Considered, Robin Hilton, the producer for All Songs Considered, headlined the show Viking's Choice, and the name stuck.
All right. Well, with a name like Lars, it makes sense to me. Let's listen to what you're listening to this week. This is called Brain Freeze by Buggin. All right. Well, I was not really expecting that, to be honest. Why did you pick this one?
You know, I have to say, I really miss shows. I don't know how much you miss them, but I deeply, badly miss going to shows. So especially when I hear a band like Buggin, I want to be in the mosh pit pushing and partying with my pals.
No kidding. You know, when that first started, I felt like I was listening to a song from the 90s, actually. It kind of has that feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, Buggin is from Chicago. Their sound is very indebted to the 80s and 90s hardcore scene out of New York. Really heavy on the groove, but seared into your skull with the raging vocals of the Brianna, who's the vocalist for the band. I really can't wait to see them rip it up in a basement someday. But, you know, you can mosh in your chair too. So that's what I'm doing a lot of these days. I'm just at my home office chair and pretending that I am in a sweaty basement with a bunch of people.
I'm going to try that and hope nobody's watching. All right. The second song on your playlist is called Zombie's Passport. Here it is. Lars, I'm getting the feeling that the music you're bringing us is a little bit outside of the mainstream and not something that you'd necessarily hear on the radio. Tell us about this one.
Sure. This is a record called Jour de Grève by Emmanuel Perhonan and Detlef Weinrich. This is obviously a very different kind of record, and it's such a kaleidoscope of sound. The idea, you know, behind trance is that it does exactly what it says. It maybe not to think too much about it, but just kind of let your body move with it.
Yeah, just go with it, you say. All right, let's get to your third pick. Here it is. That's His Wrath Will Fall by Warrior Path off their upcoming album, The Mad King. And Lars, it certainly does sound like a Viking's choice.
this is the stereotypical Viking's choice. So as much as I believe we should be present in our world as it is, I need to escape just like everyone else. So power metal to the rescue. Where knights battle dragons and warriors storm castles. You know, Dungeons and Dragons kind of stuff. This is the second album by Warrior Path, and it's a Greek metal band featuring a powerhouse singer from Sweden. Daniel Hyman has one of those classic heavy metal voices. Like, think like Ronnie James Dio. Warrior Path's got just these heroic riffs and massive guitar solos, but more importantly, it's deeply fun and the songs are super catchy.
All right, let's take the tempo down just a bit. Here's Constellation by Chuck Johnson. Just a bit after that Warrior Path song. But no, I do feel much calmer than when we first started. What do we need to know about Chuck Johnson?
Chuck Johnson has been making music for about 3 decades now. He got a start in noisy rock bands out of the Chapel Hill rock indie rock scene in the early 90s. And a decade ago, he kind of remade himself as a fingerstyle guitarist in the John Fahey style. But there was another shift. He took a particular interest in the pedal steel guitar exploring the possibilities of those long strings and drawn out tones. You know, during this pandemic, a lot of people talk about needing music to soothe their soul. It's a very common trope over the last year. The thing I appreciate about this record in particular, yes, it's very beautiful and it'll bring you into peace, but there is a sorrow to these ambient hymns. They're about the changing landscape of California, where he now lives, and how emotionally trying that can be to see the place where you live and love change from climate and change from development. I appreciate how you can have both the peace and the sorrow in one place at once.
You know, Lars, it's interesting to hear you talk about how these selections reflect on the time that we're in, because you're right, I heard that and I thought, yes, that is really hitting the moment. On the other hand, I'm hearing some of the other music that you brought in with much more energy and a little bit of almost some anger in it. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, you know, like, we're feeling that too. Like, this is all going on.
You know, music, it meets you where you're supposed to be. The thing that I've had to tell myself over the last year is to really lean in to all the emotions and ideas and anger and joys that come as they come. So when I hear stuff like this that can accept me at my lowest lows, but also bring to my highest highs, you know, that's where I want to be.
And here's your last pick. It's a new single from Don Richard's new album titled Second Line.
does it for me. Feet, feed me with the beat. Feet, feed me with the beat. Bust it for me.
I mentioned the album name is Second Line. You can actually hear the reference to New Orleans in that name, but also a little bit in the music there at some points, too. Seems appropriate for this time of year.
Dawn just announced her new album on Mardi Gras. She is New Orleans proud. I just find Dawn Richard so inspiring. Here's someone who got her start with Danny DeCane. You may remember them from Puff Daddy's reality show Making the Band. And Dawn's experience on that side of the music industry left her absolutely shook. So she went solo, or as she likes to say, indie but major. And she is just a chameleon of pop music, bending R&B, the avant-garde, dance and electronic music to her will. But what's really given me life with this song is that when I'm not leaving my home, I've got a toddler who just discovered Baby Shark, and I'm missing nightlife, is that this song brings me to the club, and I really can't wait for y'all to hear the rest of this album.
You're desperate for something there, Lars, aren't you? We gotta get this thing over with. Lars Gotrich, writer and producer for NPR Music. He also writes the Vikings Choice newsletter. You've opened our eyes here to a lot of good stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank y'all so much for having me.
And we'll link you to all of Lars's music at hereandnow.org. President Joe Biden delivered his first speech today to an international audience, emphasizing to a group of European leaders the importance of allies standing together on the issues of arms control, the pandemic, and climate change. Biden also offered to rejoin negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program. He said transparency is critical.
That's why we said we're prepared to re-engage in negotiations with the P5 plus one on Iran's nuclear program.
That deal was signed by the Obama administration in 2015, but President Trump pulled out. He called it a horrible, one-sided agreement that should have never been made. Jim Walsh is Here and Now security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies program. Jim, welcome. And President Biden says he was willing to negotiate with Iran to get that deal going again. That's a big shift. What's your take?
Well, he campaigned on it. And so, certainly it was a legacy piece of his the previous administration he served in. So it's no surprise that he endorsed it. I mean, the situation now is that Iran is increasingly outside of any set of restrictions beyond its the typical safeguards agreement. But the extra special, great, intrusive rules we had under the Iran agreement have been slowly deteriorating once the U.S. pulled out. And so there's good reason to want to get back in. And these are good signals. He did some other stuff. He rescinded three letters the Trump administration had sent to the UN as part of this process. He's asked the Europeans to convene a meeting. And so these are all positive steps. But I would say this, Peter, you know, this is the definition of low-hanging fruit here. If you went outside and you saw a tree and there were low-hanging fruit, you would also see the Iran nuclear agreement. I mean, all the parties had already agreed to it. And it had been working, according to all the parties, when it changed and the U.S. pulled out. And Congress had already reviewed it. So I think he needs to move swiftly, because if he dawdles and this gets bogged down, it'll get away from him and he'll regret it. So I think it's a great move. But, you know, time is of the essence here.
Yeah, as you rightly say, Iran was far outside the terms of the agreement since Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal. So in that time, how much closer have the Iranians gotten to a weapon since everything started falling apart?
I mean, I would say this. The big thing, and it's hard for folks to remember, but the DNI, the top U.S. intelligence official, said years ago that if Iran truly, truly wanted to build a nuclear weapon, it could do it. I mean, you can't bomb the knowledge of how to build a centrifuge out of their heads. They've enriched uranium. So if they really just woke up tomorrow and said, you know, we're going to do this come hell or high water, they could. And so what these negotiations are about are trying to find a different path so Iran ends up not choosing to get the bomb. And then the way to do that is through where they make voluntary, they do things and open up and are transparent. And in return, they get, you know, relief from sanctions. Now, are they closer? Yes, because they have, you know, they've accumulated a bigger stockpile of uranium and they're deploying more centrifuges. So at the margins, yes, they're getting closer. But all these are things they can reverse. And they said they would reverse them if we all get in the old agreement, compliance for compliance. So that's what the race is. But if, for, you know, if something happens tomorrow and there's some incident somewhere in the world and things go south, then they have, you know, an unconstrained nuclear program.
Yeah. You know, both sides are probably going to be reluctant to get back into these talks without getting something in return. You kind of hinted at this a little bit. What do you think the negotiations will look like? What will each side be seeking here?
Oh, man. Well, this is a situation where you hope that just plain old national interest and common sense prevails, because obviously the Iranians are walking in and they're ticked, right? They went into the deal. You know, they made all these promises. Their domestic population, you know, supported them in doing this. And then the U.S. walked out and made them look like, you know, stooges. So they're not happy. You know, they want compensation. And there's no way the U.S. is going to give compensation. And the U.S. is feeling, well, you know, now that I'm back in, I want things too. So the thing is, both parties have to get up beyond that, get real, lock down the agreement that they already have in front of them, and then sit down and try to work out something better. But the first order of business is taking care of what you've got. And to do that, you are absolutely right. This very testy, multi-decade relationship, the people on the negotiating table are going to have to put some of that emotion aside and deal with what's what makes sense first.
Yeah. How is Joe Biden going to figure out how to handle the situation with Israel, though? Because you know that Israel does not want this deal to get back up and running again. Israel and Iran have long been enemies, and the U.S. and Israel have long been allies.
Yeah, the reality is, and it's, I was talking to a group the other day, Iran has been in a nuclear deal since 2013. You know, that's 7 years. 7 years I've been talking about this. And, you know, Israel opposed it all during those 7 years. Iran gets back in. Everyone gets back in. It'll just, you know, they'll be unhappy, but there's not much they can do about it. And it's in their interest. No one should want Iran to have an unconstrained nuclear program that could turn to the bomb. Everyone wins.
Jim Walsh, maybe 7 years from now, we'll still be talking. No, I hope not. Jim Walsh, here and now security analyst. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.